Hello and welcome to episode 158 of Speak Beastie for August 21st, 2022. I'm Anne.
I'm Amy.
I'm Marjolaine.
And I'm Shannon.
Yay.
Hi.
Yeah.
All together.
Yeah, we're back.
We're all here. The core four. We're back together again.
Reunited.
Name a more iconic quartet besides Newt and Tina and Queenie and Jacob.
I was about to say, it feels like Queenie's and Jacob's wedding at the end of the movie.
Oh, yeah. Well, speaking of people who are iconic, I want to give a shout out to this week's Speak Beastie Patreon supporter, Sophie!
Yay, Sophie!
Number one Tina stan! So, thank you for your support. This show literally could not happen without you.
Yeah, and thank you for your incredible Tina's content every day on Instagram. It's
yes!
And Twitter.
All right, so we do have a little bit of news today in the Phoenix Register.
And now a message from our sponsors.
Hey you, yes you, the magical cats and dolls waving your wands like bean shooters in a caper. Looking to be on the up and up about Newt's commander, famous zoologist and world traveler? No need for gossip at the juice joint, just tune your ears to Speak Beastie. And now for as little as one dragon dollar a month, you can make Speak Beastie the Neasles Meow. Support the show at patreon.com and suddenly you're the big cheese, the real McCoy, with exclusive access to swell sneak peeks, bloopers, and behind the scenes features. But wait, there's more. Sponsors can also beat their gums at the joint with access to the Speak Beastie Common Room on Facebook. Now you're really on the clean sweep, flyboy. Get a wiggle on to patreon.com/speakbeastie to learn more about becoming a sponsor today. It's the Billy Wigs knees and how.
This first bit is kind of cool, and I'm very excited about this. So we could be getting closer to being able to actually have wizard duels at Universal theme parks.
What?
Yes! I need this to happen because it seems so cool. So, a little background. Earlier this year, Universal filed a patent that would allow park visitors to duel, casting spells, and there would be, like, light effects involved and stuff. Now they filed another patent called Variable Effects Activation in an Interactive Environment. It's basically building on the other one, and this technology would allow the wand system to respond even if the caster is not making a specific spell motion. So it seems like the idea behind this is to make the dueling feature more accessible to the most park visitors. So those who maybe don't have a lot of range of motion, or those who don't know a bunch of the spell movements, they can still participate and take part in this part of the experience. So I need this to happen. And I'm wondering if this is going to get, like, rolled out when the new park opens in Orlando?
Yeah, maybe.
Probably. And, I mean,
because it would be easier to incorporate it into a new park first before.
Yeah, right. I bet it's probably going to be, like, the Sorcerers of the Magic Kingdom spots. Where it's got to be certain spots where you can do it. That way the wands can pick up the RFID. I mean, the magic works better in certain spots of the theme park than others.
Yeah.
They already have, for listeners who don't know, the parks already have, like, interactive wands. And there are spots where you can, like, cast little spells, but just on objects in windows and things like that. And they create effects.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'm wondering if this is going to be like that, where there are certain spots, like, pretty much throughout the parks, or if this is going to be more like an Ollivander's experience type thing, and, like, something you queue up for, and maybe there's only, like, one in the park.
Yeah. And it reminds me also of the Forbidden Forest experience, where you can cast a Patronus in the woods and... It was, with lighting effect.
Cool.
And, really, really cool effect. So, they are trying some things and more immersive experience. So that's exciting.
Yeah. I'm here for it.
I'm guessing that this isn't going to be backwards compatible with the wands that are already existent.
Of course not.
Universal.
How silly of you, man.
My bad. I was really hoping that the $100 already spent on interactive wands would be worth something, but...
And the ones to do this particular type are probably going to be like $70 instead of
$50. Yeah.
But we're all gonna buy one, let's be real.
Yeah. Well, and I'm a Universal Annual Pass holder now, so.
Oh, you get a discount. Oh.
Yeah.
So shopping
Unless
with
it'll
Shannon.
Probably take like 3 years for this to happen. So it is.
Well, because I know Epic Universe isn't even in talks to open until like 24, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it is not. It's like, it's nothing. It's a pile of dirt right now. Like,
yeah.
But
yeah,
fingers crossed.
Well, whenever it does open, I'm gonna put this on the calendar now. We're gonna have a Speak Beastie meet up there, and I'm gonna duel Amy.
Yes,
I love any meetup.
She's gonna win,
and I am going to win. I love that you said it, and I didn't have to say it because I'm ridiculously competitive. It's fine.
You're ridiculously competitive, and I have really bad hand-eye coordination, so you're gonna wipe the floor with me. But I'm still gonna do it.
It's gonna be a good time. We'll have like a dueling club with like, you know, the brackets and stuff.
Oh man, yes.
Yes.
I mean, last episode was already a dueling club between Shannon and Jeff. So
it was.
Oh boy. Okay. So our news this episode is very theme park central. Yeah. But there's also this new development, not super new, but it happened after our last episode dropped. Vegan Butterbeer is now available at Universal Parks in both Orlando and Hollywood. So if you've ever had the Butterbeer in the parks, it's the whipped cream topping on top of the drink that is non-vegan. So if you can remove that, the drink is vegan. Employees used to not be allowed to do that. It had to be served with the whipped topping. It was, I guess, I don't know, part of the branded experience. But that has now changed, and the topping is now optional. So if you do want a vegan butterbeer, you can just specify to leave off the topping when you order.
And that's going to be a shout out to the Protego Foundation.
Yeah.
And friend of the pod, Tyler Allen Starr, for spearheading that campaign. So congratulations.
Yeah. They've been working on this for years.
I saw Tyler at LeakyCon.
Wow.
They were really pushing that during LeakyCon. Should like do a Patreon content where I go and drink all the butterbeers.
You should.
Do it. The hot butterbeer is the best.
Yeah.
So good.
And actually, we have another piece of news that I forgot to add because it's very recent. We had a big news yesterday about Hogwarts Legacy.
Yes.
We have a release date, February 10.
Right.
So later than we were expecting. It was supposed to be December, but that's cool.
To be clear, that is for, I believe, PC, PS5, and...
For the Switch, we don't know yet.
Yeah, we don't have a release date for the Switch, because I guess if we have a Switch, you don't deserve answers.
I think the Switch version was an afterthought, so they probably need more time to...
Yeah.
I mean, Nintendo Switch is a very different platform than the PlayStation...
Oh, sure, yeah.
4 or 5, so I guess...
I mean, it gives me more time to save up to buy a Switch, so I'm not really complaining.
Get the Switch Lite. It's a little cheaper.
Yeah.
That's what I have.
Yeah.
Although it's funny, because it can't switch.
Oh, how ironic. It's just a Nintendo now.
So that's Switch without a Switch.
Yeah, that's what I have, but I want to invest into a PlayStation 4. Now that I have a proper TV, I want to play it.
Yeah, like, part of me wants a PS5, but then I'm like, literally the only games I would have for it are Hogwarts Legacy and the Final Fantasy VII remake. And
right.
Is that worth a PS5 price? I don't know.
And we still can't have PS5. I mean, at least where I am, and they're not available, so.
Oh, really? Oh, no.
Yeah. I mean, I've heard they're still pretty hard to get over here, too. So you're not alone in that.
Yeah. I mean, I bought my Switch exclusively to play Animal Crossing, and that was worth it.
So. Oh, same. That was my first buy for the first lockdown.
Oh, yeah. Sure.
Anyway. Well, shall we check out this post from the owls?
Yes, that sounds great. And actually, we have a perfect segue for it because we're talking about Hogwarts Legacy.
Yes, that's right. Because Diskid sent us a message about the Deathly Hallows video game games. Because we talked about that a little bit on the last episode. So Diskid wrote, "Big gamer here, especially the Harry Potter games. I will say that you guys are correct that Deathly Hallows, and that goes for both of them, was the worst video game of the entire Harry Potter years series. It was more of a third-person shooter action game than it was a game where you could be enchanted by and explore being in the wizarding world as you could the previous games. I can cut the makers a little slack that the game did not take place in Hogwarts for the most part, so they did lack a lot of what they could do in the older games that made it so popular. They probably felt with the plot the player was more limited with free time than in previous games, such as rewards for the Bertie Bott's Beans, Quidditch games, secret passageways, extra house point tasks, and more limited spellcasting / practices in general. But I don't give them a pass either because they were pretty lazy with it and didn't try hard enough when it came to rewards and a magical exploration feel. They still could have had a better reward system than the game had and put more effort into giving it a magical feeling. Like, they could have allowed you to cast more spells for fun and find special objects and places for it. Heck, I would have thought it was cool to even do more of my own minor tasks, such as summoning the objects I needed. So I'll give it that it was going to be a different game from previous games, but they could have been better. My favorite is, and always will be, the first two games on almost any platform, though I think if I was forced to pick, I would say Chamber of Secrets PS2 was the best one, with Sorcerer's Stone PC being a good runner-up. I'll give Hogwarts Legacy a chance, since it is a different team than the creative vision behind Deathly Hallows, but I will be the first to call them out on a bad game if that's what it ends up being."
Yeah.
And we will be excited to hear your emails about
Yes, please. Send us your reviews once it comes out.
It's so funny because I would think that being able to go outside of Hogwarts would make for a better game. But yeah, it's like they didn't even try.
Yeah, they just didn't know what to do.
Yeah, I mean, it's a difference between, like, as I said, making it like a third-person shooter versus doing like an open-world Skyrim kind of thing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And actually, I learned a lot about the what happened with the development of the Harry Potter games because I interviewed a guy who did a whole study exploration with the developers of the time for the first four games. And it was very different from after the first four. They completely changed the development system, the which studios worked on them, and the time that they could spend on the development too. But the development of the first ones are really, really interesting. Also how they collaborate with the movie teams and with J.K. Rowling and very, very interesting stuff. So
yeah, I think I only played the first four.
Same.
I had them in like a box set.
Yeah. I loved the Prisoner of Azkaban PC one. That was like one of my favorites.
I had
Order of the Phoenix for the Wii. It was awful.
No, my favorite one is still the Quidditch World Cup game.
Yes.
On PC. Very, very
That was fun.
My heart belongs to the Lego games. I will always play them.
Like, I got them. I had at least like the first couple on Wii. But then when there was like a sale last year on them, I got
on the Switch,
on Switch. Yeah.
Yep.
Yeah, I have them, but I can't with the Lego games. I don't know why, but it doesn't work for me.
No, fair enough.
Sure.
Not for everyone.
It's a whole different kind of thing.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's very different. It's very different aesthetic and feel to the games. It's definitely not a very serious Harry Potter video game. But I do remember I was at a trivia contest once, and the first round was name the minifig.
Oh my god.
And so the rest of my team was like, oh my god. And I was like, sit down, y'all, I got this one. I played. You have no idea how many hours of Lego Harry Potter I played. I was born for this.
Well, so we do have another owl post from Hadley. Hi, Speak Beastie. I live in the Yukon, but this summer I was in Toronto, and I got to go to the Fantastic Beasts Wonder of Nature exhibit at the Royal Ontario Museum. I thought it was really awesome. Lots of props from the movies, and Catherine Waterston voiced a few videos about endangered species. Overall, it was a fun and unique exhibit that I recommend to any Harry Potter fan. I also went to Universal Orlando this summer, and there was surprisingly almost no Fantastic Beasts merchandise. It has been a Potter-filled summer. I wanted to share with you and get your thoughts. Thanks so much for doing what you do. Thank you
for the
Hadley.
Trip report, Hadley. Yeah. What a delight.
That sounds so fun. I love this exhibit. It's so fun. It's the one that we went with Oreo last year. Mm-hmm. So when it was in London. And yeah, this exhibition is very, very nice. And it's cool that we have report from the exhibition touring. I hope it will tour in other places. I don't know if they announced that, but yeah.
I would love to go
to
this.
Orlando.
Yeah, it looked really cool.
Mm-hmm. And there is almost no Fantastic Beasts merch at the parks. You are correct. There is some. Depending on when you went, there might have not been a lot yet, but they came out with a bit more like this summer.
Yep. I always think about when we went to Universal Hollywood. We were in the parks on the day that the first Fantastic movie dropped. I was ready. I was going to give them 45 of my hard-earned American dollars for a replica of Queenie Goldstein's wand. And they were like, no, Anne, we do not want your 45
they were like,
hard-earned
no,
American
Anne,
dollars.
We don't accept dollars. This is the Wizarding
We
world.
Only accept wizard bucks.
Oh.
Because there was zero Fantastic Beasts merch. And I remember looking at Chris as we were leaving and being like, are they just leaving money on the table? They knew this movie was coming out, right? Somebody told Warner Brothers.
They got some in after Crimes of Grindelwald, but still not a lot.
Yeah, they do have some of the wands now. And then, this summer came out with some, like, Hogshead stuff and some Beast stuff.
It's just a shame because, like, there's such, the Berlin Ministry of Magic, the designs are so beautiful, and I would buy, like, a keychain or a pin or something with that logo they designed for it, but guess not.
Well, that is it for the owl post, so wave goodbye to the owls.
Thanks for coming, owls. Well, the owls have left, which means we can move into our main discussion. We are going to be discussing scenes 10 through, I think it's 14? In the screenplay. So that is going to be the scene where Credence brings the Keenan back to forgot the name of the castle.
Nurmengard.
Nurmengard, thank you. I got it mixed up with something that's going to be coming up later in this episode.
You got it mixed up with
the wrong one. Don't say the wrong one. And then also the scene where the Scamander boys meet up with Dumbledore. So we're starting with scene 10. We are in the castle entrance/courtyard at Nurmengard in the morning. Credence and the Acolytes return with, I refer to it as the Bag of Kieran. Bag of Kieran, because, like you do. And Grindelwald dismisses them. One or two of the Acolytes glance back, a way that Credence is now the favorite, which makes me wonder what they've been up to for these last 4 years that he's now the favorite.
And actually, we only see Vinda looking like, huh.
Yeah, right?
She was a little slow to catch on.
It's not as, clear of a moment in the movie as it is in the screenplay.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there's a couple of things like that that I mentioned here that they make a point to deal about it in the screenplay, but then you watch the movie and the intention isn't really clear.
Yeah.
But
yeah.
Anyway, in the screenplay, they also describe the Keaton as eyes being damp and phlegm drizzling from its quivering nose, which is so gross. Like, why are you doing that to my poor little Keenan baby?
And they didn't do that in the movie.
No.
Yeah, that's a fine change. We didn't need that.
Yeah, the Chilling looks confused, but not that sick, I guess.
Yeah, no, it seems fine.
Maybe they were like, if we make it look gross, people won't be as upset over what's coming.
Because gross babies are fine to kill. It's fine.
Okay.
Oh.
make that the episode title.
Gross. Please don't take that out of context.
That's just going to be the teaser audio for this episode.
Speak Beastie host Anne thinks it's okay to kill gross-looking babies.
I can see the like hit website now all about Anne.
Oh, no, I'm going to get canceled. What's happening?
I will quote Amy for that. It's just Anne explaining what Amy was saying.
Yeah, Anne just said the... Once you
remove the sound from the context, it's I'm gonna say yeah because it's fine to kill gross babies, and then people will be like, it's gonna be on the Tonight Show.
Yep, yep, all over the place. Yeah.
It's gonna be in the Phoenix Register
next episode.
Oh, anyway, speaking of people who like to kill babies, Grindelwald places his hand on Credence's cheek. Credence covers Grindelwald's hand with his own, tentatively, as if unfamiliar with such intimate touch. And if you watch the movie, like, Grindelwald puts his hand on Credence's cheek, and then you can hear the slap when Credence puts his hand on top of Grindelwald's. Yeah. Like, this is not tentative. This is just like, yes!
Yeah, it did not need to be tentative for me to know that Credence is unfamiliar with such intimate touch.
Like, it has, like, major, did you put your name in the Goblet of Fire vibes.
Seriously.
Like, this is, like, subtle, but then, bam, actually on film.
I prefer the, Ezra's interpretation of that because it's more, I mean, I don't see Credence be like, oh, I'm shy, I don't know. No, his mind is messed up, and that's how. And it reminds us of what happened with Grindelgraves in the first movie. So.
Yeah. It shows more like desperation than if it were to be tentative.
It's honestly, it's really sad actually when you see him with the thirst for contact that he has. Still, he's been living with Grindelwald in Nurmengard for like 3-4 years at this point, and he's still that desperate to be touched.
I mean, you can also have another interpretation because he was bitten by his mom, so it can also be not first but like a defensive, like grabbing the hand, like expecting to be hit. But, you can see it either way, I guess.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so either way, it's coming from a very unhealthy coping mechanism.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And the last thing in this scene is there's a very pretty rendering of Nurmengard as, like, some concept art. And you can really see the inspiration of Neuschwanstein Castle in Bavaria in there. Like, the angle that they draw it at, it looks very much like... I can't say everyone knows that, like, iconic picture of Neuschwanstein Castle, but it's the one, when you think of Neuschwanstein Castle, it's the one you think of, and it's very similar.
I do really love all the concept art that's in the screenplay book.
Yeah, we especially get a lot in this whole section.
Yeah.
But I'm still a bit bothered that they don't quote the artist.
And I think that's true.
Weird, because in the concept art book that we have, we can have the concept artist quoted for, and you can see that it's different artists. There, it's only one that, because we recognize the style, but I wish we had their name.
That's
weird that we don't.
You know,
have
that
the
is
name.
Weird. I didn't even think about that, but yeah, that the art isn't signed is a little bit unusual.
Yeah.
Well, let's write to WB.
We're moving on to scene 11. Interior, drawing room, same time, morning. And the Keaton looks at Grindelwald, quote, weary gaze meeting Grindelwald's expectant one, and is like, LOL, no, so naturally Grindelwald has to kill it.
I really love that in the screenplay because that makes it very clear Grindelwald is like, oh, I'll give you a chance, are you gonna bow to me?
Right.
Yeah.
Whereas in the movie he's just like, all right, you're out.
And that he's expectant that it will. Like, he really thinks he's the leader.
Yeah.
Because just, he said just before to Credence, like, what is the shilling and the fact that every time a shilling is born, it means the righteous leader will appear. And you understand with that, with the script, that he wants the Chilling to have the confirmation that he is the righteous leader. So
yeah, it's like when it didn't, he was like, all right, well, we gotta force this and do some deception here.
Yeah, I think he already had plan B in his mind, but he was, okay, I think I am, but it would be good for the Chilling to confirm that.
Yeah. Something interesting is this scene descriptor says interior drawing room, but all of this in the film takes place in the same place outside.
Yeah, so I think it's supposed to be interior drawing room that Queenie is in the drawing room watching through like the window to the courtyard.
Yeah, there are a couple of shots that are from Queenie's point of view, like over her shoulder.
Right. But she's not in the drawing room. She's just in the front doorway.
Yeah. Right. So that got changed a little bit, it seems like.
Yeah.
Yeah. In the screenplay, it says that reaching out, he gently lifts it to its feet, steadying it, then positions himself in front of it. For a moment, nothing. Then slowly, the Kitten's head lifts, its weary gaze meeting Grindelwald's expectant one. Then it turns away. And again, in the movie, like, there is a moment where the Kitten does look up and, like, look at Grindelwald, but honestly, the whole thing doesn't read as much as it is making eye contact with him, judging him, and deeming him unworthy. It reads more as, this is a tiny, squirmy baby, and it is looking around and wanting to explore.
Well, especially since that, that's really not explained to us yet, that that's what the Chilling does. So, as an audience member watching this, you wouldn't understand that he's waiting for it to recognize him and bow to him or whatever. I mean, because we don't know that yet as an audience.
Grindelwald said just before that the Chilling look into the soul or something like that, or his these eyes see something, like I don't remember the
he
quote
says
exactly.
Those eyes see everything. When a Chilling is born, a righteous leader will rise to change our world forever.
And you see Grindelwald forcing the Chilling to look at him, like taking the head of the Chilling, but but you don't know that it's supposed to bow. So
yeah, the lore isn't fully explored,
and I feel like you don't see, like, the screenplay says after it turns away, like, Grindelwald's face hardens. I feel like you don't see all that from Grindelwald either.
No,
the scene.
But you see deception. You see disappointment. He's like looking down and biting his lip, like, okay.
That's true.
Yeah, I think honestly, more than anything, it's almost like the way it was filmed and edited. Like, you needed, like, a longer close-up on, you needed that longer moment of, like, eye contact, and then it
definitely
to fully kind of get across that he is expecting something to happen. But, yeah, it's also that they haven't explained yet that something could happen. But it's very sad either way.
It is. And screenplay does not mention that Grindelwald is holding it and rocking it while it dies, which is also super gross.
It's like this weird, like, regretful moment of, like, oh, man, I killed you, but you forced me to do it. But
look,
I'm
what
gonna
you
rob
made
you.
Me do.
Yeah, it's like this weird, oh, I don't like it.
I like it because it shows so much of Grindelwald's character by, I mean, this decision of just adding that. And just with this little scene, because, as you know, I don't have the movie yet. It's not out on DVD in France, but this scene is on YouTube, so I could analyze it, unlike the next one. But yeah, I was really appreciative of seeing how Mads is adding stuff from the screenplay. So
then we get the vision in the blood.
Yep, and in the screenplay it says, a vision of pool appears in the pool in blood of two figures seen from on high walking in the snow. And then in the movie they also added Dumbledore looking at the blood troth as well.
Yeah.
But then we see the Scamander boys heading down
towards
Hogsmeade.
I like the shot of Dumbledore because it kind of shows that, like, that's who Grindelwald is thinking about first. Mm-hmm. And Lily's like, no, no. I need to
No, let me think about focus. Something other than that boy I like. So speaking of them boys, we are hopping over to scene 12. It's exterior Hogsmeade day.
We get a nice location rendering of
beautiful of Hogsmeade. And I know it's supposed to because they literally use the art from the movies to make the park, but I'm like, oh, it's just like the park. And
yeah, you've got those two boys in their scarves.
Got them boys in their scarves. And my summation of this scene is Newt is shady and Theseus is suspicious.
Yeah.
Because it's really just Theseus saying, I don't suppose you'd like to tell me what this is about, and Newt be like, nope.
No.
I'm good, thanks. And so scene 13, we cut to the interior of the Hogshead moments later, day, where we have Aberforth running a dirty rag over the mirror behind the bar, his suspicious gaze shifting as Newt and Theseus in reflection enter. And it just made me think, in Order of the Phoenix, when they first head over to the Hogshead, isn't he cleaning his glasses, like, yes. his cups with a dirty rag? Like, dude, yes. you are doing no one any good.
But I think this is interesting because this is a hint to, like, the messages in the mirror.
Oh, that's true.
That we don't know about yet.
Yeah.
And I didn't, think back to this moment. I also like that it specifies he has a beard.
Yes.
Yeah. Bearded proprietor. Just, like, he must be bearded.
If it's a nod also from the first time that we see Aberforth in the books, it's through Sirius' mirror. So,
mm-hmm. yeah.
Again, oh, that's true. Yeah.
I like it. It's
introduced through the reflection of the mirror. That's that.
Yeah,
I like that.
Then Aberforth, he had to meet my brother, I expect, and...
That's a perfect impression.
That's my Richard Doyle impersonation.
I can't believe that
I am available for hire on video games. I can do dubbing. And then Newt tries to shake Aberforth's hand, and Aberforth is also like, lol, no, but surprisingly, Newt manages not to kill him.
I really appreciate that, like, Newt is trying to be sociable.
Yeah, he's doing his best.
He's like, trying so hard. You shake someone's hand. Oh, this one doesn't want to shake my hand. Theseus, what have I done?
Theseus, did I do it wrong?
Oh, this is awkward.
Yeah, like, normally it's me who doesn't understand what the other one wants to do. But...
Do I leave my hand out here, or do I put it down?
Theseus, can you explain to this? Can you give him the talk about handshaking that he had? We have another rendering.
Yep, and it does look a little bit like Theseus and Newt, like, it looks a little bit like Eddie and Callum. Mm-hmm.
With some Prisoner of Azkaban hair, I gotta say.
Yeah, it was like, the rendering of Aberforth does not look like what Aberforth ended up in the movie. He looks a little bit more akin to the way Kieran Hines played him in Deathly Hallows, with the longer hair and the more unkempt beard, as opposed to what we got in this movie, which is much more kempt Aberforth. Yeah.
I would have liked him to be a little bit messier looking.
Yeah.
I think that's still very in character for him as a young man. He's got this nice sweater vest on in the rendering, too.
Yeah. Looking very dapper.
And then you see some of the, the room. It looks like the Hogshead, looks like what we see in the movie.
And then the boys head up to the upper room in the Hogshead, scene 14, interior upper room, Hogshead, continuous day. Theseus and Dumbledore have a little bit of an alpha male off. Dumbledore says, has Newt told you why you're here? Theseus says, was he meant to? Dumbledore eyes Theseus, clocking the mild challenges tone, and Dumbledore says, no, as a matter of fact.
And poor Newt is just awkwardly shifting in the corner. And Newt's just like,
I don't understand male posturing.
Newt's like, no, you told me not to. Was I supposed to?
I'm uncomfortable.
Aberforth didn't shake my hand. I'm so confused.
I just want to go back and pet my Kelpie.
There's a lot of, people eyeing each other and considering each other, but never, Newt eyeing someone. It's like Dumbledore eyes Theseus. Uh-huh. Theseus's eyes shift to Newt. Theseus considers his brother, then Dumbledore. And I think there's that in, like, the Hogshead in the scene with Aberforth, too. Like, Aberforth eyes them.
Yep, yep, yep.
And you know what?
Just all these men, like, I don't know.
Those are the moments that I love so much in these movies. Like, I feel like that happens in all three movies, where you get this, like, silent acting with, like, looks and eyes and stuff. And I love it. Like, it's so... Yeah. It's such good character acting.
I do think it's funny, though, a little character, that it's like, Newt is never doing that, because Newt's just being, you know, Newt. Yep. He doesn't need to eye anybody.
His eyes are on the floor. He's never going to look at anybody.
And we have this quote from Eddie. Oh, you do have that.
It's at the end, so that's where
I put it. We'll come back to it.
And... Dumbledore busts out the blood troth, and Theseus, like, I understand he's a cop, so he's probably seen this kind of stuff before, but it seems very fast that he jumps immediately from, oh, that's a pretty necklace, to, oh, that's a blood troth.
Yeah.
Yeah. Was this, like, more common back in the day, maybe?
Maybe.
Maybe. Maybe it was, like, like the Charleston. Oh, you know, you dance Charleston all night, and then make a blood troth with your best of cakes.
Yeah. It's in style. In the 20s and 30s.
Yeah, at first I thought that Newt might have told him, but now we know that Newt didn't told anything to Theseus, so no, probably not. Because, yeah, Newt knows because they talk about it with Dumbledore at the end of movie 2, so...
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But it's clear that Newt didn't talk about it at all with his brother, so...
Nope.
Yeah.
I really liked the description of the blood troth. Mm-hmm. The screenplay says, Theseus nods, eyeing the troth, watching as the droplets of blood circle one another like weights in a clock.
Yeah, it's a very evocative description.
Mm-hmm.
And Theseus is eyeing things again. Okay, on the next page I will say, Newt eyes Dumbledore.
Oh!
But, expectantly.
Dumbledore gives a demonstration of what happens if he tries to fight Grindelwald.
And this is just the worst.
And I get the chain constricting around Dumbledore and trying to, like, strangle him.
Yeah.
I do not get why the blood trove is just like, goodbye!
The only thing I could think is it, like, simultaneously trying to kill Dumbledore while running away from him for, like, self-preservation?
I don't know.
Because it's, like, the actual part containing the blood detaches itself from the chain. And it's kind of like, nope, I'm out of here. Like, I don't want to be destroyed.
It, like, keep my chain. Is it trying to go to Grindelwald?
Oh, maybe. That would make
That's
sense.
That's what I thought, yeah.
But yeah, it's not clear.
It's almost like, you know, like those lizards that can, like, drop their tail and run away?
Yeah.
It's like, all right, I'm gonna drop my chain and run away.
Hold my chain. This scene is so much.
Yeah.
Like, I remember this was one of the scenes that dropped before the movie came
out. Yeah, and I'm still mad that it did, because I saw it... out of context of the movie, I that's weird. But I saw it so many times before seeing the movie that when I saw it in the movie, maybe it would be more impactful. Mm-hmm. But now it was just, okay, I already saw that. So.
Yeah, yeah. So. I think it's really interesting, like, the struggle between Dumbledore and, like, trying to, like... It's almost like he has to rein in his thoughts of betraying Grindelwald and, like, squash those feelings in order for that thing to come back and, like, go back to normal and be benign instead of, like, trying to kill him.
Yeah.
And isn't it a weird note at the beginning of the... Like, Dumbledore is smiling or something like that? I didn't... not that, but...
A strange smile coming over his face, as if he were in thrall to it.
Yeah, like, it doesn't really come across in the movie. What you get in the movie is, it almost feels like he's indulging in it because he feels like he deserves it.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Whereas this makes it more, I don't know, fetishy?
Yeah.
Yeah, in the movie, I was definitely like, oh, this is self-harm.
Yeah.
Which you get a little bit in the screenplay, but yeah, it The screenplay descriptions make me uncomfortable. I don't know, man.
I know. It does have one of my favorite moments in the whole movie is when Dumbledore is like, it's twisting around his arm and he says, "It senses the betrayal in my heart," and his voice cracks a little bit and his hair is flopping into his eyes. And I was just sitting there next to my husband, just like, I love seeing pretty boys in pain. Oh, it was so great. And that one you can take out of context because I'm not ashamed of that one. And then basically at the end of the scene, Theseus is like, well, I don't trust you, but my dumb brother does, so I guess I will too. And I really wish that they'd left the Theseus meets the Teelan scene in, because with how secretive Newt is about everything else, it doesn't make any sense that he would have voluntarily talked about the Teelan to Theseus.
This scene starts with, like, Newt didn't tell me anything.
Yeah.
But I know about the baby giraffe.
Yeah.
Right. There's no explanation of how he knows.
Yeah, so it makes it seem like Newt would have told him, but that doesn't make sense. We have no context for it.
Yeah.
Also, the scene's very cute, and I just would like to see more boys playing with baby animals in general.
And singing.
Yes, that too. And we wrap up these two scenes with two quotes, one from Eddie Redmayne and one from Jude Law. I'll just go ahead and read them and then we can comment. Quote from Eddie Redmayne is, Dumbledore has always been an enigma. He's got this spark, this kind of playful quality to him whilst dealing with ridiculously high stakes. But there's also kind of a slightly father-son, master-apprentice connection between Dumbledore and Newt. In the past movies, Dumbledore's kind of sent Newt out to do his dirty work for him. In this film, he's beginning to let him in. Then Jude Law says, it's an interesting time in Dumbledore's life. The man that we all grew to love through the Harry Potter films is not fully formed yet, so we get to see an Albus going through big emotional and life-changing decisions and situations. All of those lead him to become the much-loved sage headmaster Albus Dumbledore in later years. So we see him confronting his past, confronting old friends, old foes, and also confronting himself.
Yeah.
Hmm. Yeah.
Both good assessments.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Eddie saying the, like, master-apprentice thing just made me think of Merlin.
Oh!
And, like, Merlin and Gaius in the TV show Merlin. If Newt was just much sassier and wore purple, I guess. I just think about Merlin a lot. So and that's all.
The slightly father-son master-apprentice immediately made me think of, like, Luke and Vader.
Yeah, I was a master apprentice. My mind goes to Star Wars before Merlin. But
well, that is interesting because I'm like, I think of father son and master apprentice as two very different dynamics. True. But it does kind of both kind of make sense. Like, Newt and Dumbledore are somewhere in between those two.
Yeah, like, I don't know if I'd necessarily say it's like a father son relationship necessarily. Yeah. Just, I would say almost more like uncle-nephew.
Sure,
like, it definitely feels
like
some kind of familial connection, but not necessarily an immediate nuclear family.
Well, I think, like, we don't really know what happened to Newt's dad.
Yeah, that's true.
So I'm like, I guess it makes sense that Newt, you know, made this connection with Dumbledore as a student, and so he never, as far as we know, never actually had, like, a father figure. Mm. So Dumbledore is the closest he's ever had to a father figure.
There's definitely, like, more there than Master Apprentice, it feels like.
Yes.
You know, there's more of an emotional connection as well than just a learning one.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, I see the father-son like something like, especially in movie two, like, Newt didn't choose that Dumbledore would be, his father figure, but it's like, you don't choose who your father is, but he respects him. But, like, he's Dumbledore. He's my father-like.
I mean, just like, this is the only one I've ever had, so. Mm-hmm. And Theseus is like, we don't need a father figure.
You have me. Let me be weirdly paternal towards you.
The hippogriffs were our fathers.
Oh, so it adds something to the little challenge between Dumbledore and Theseus.
Oh, that's true.
Yeah. Like, Theseus, like, is okay, you have more emotional connection to my brother than myself, so that's...
Yeah.
I don't like that.
Yeah.
Oh, that's interesting. I hadn't thought about that.
It's like a little competition thing.
Yeah, like they're both staking out territory.
Yeah.
And Dumbledore's like, no, no, Theseus, listen, I don't actually care.
I'm going to just send your brother off.
I like to use people, see? I know he cares. I'm joking. Don't send owls. Am I?
I was going to say, I can hear Helene already composing a very angry email.
He cares, but he doesn't like to express that he cares. He doesn't want people to think that he cares.
Yes.
No, he'd rather just enigmatically slide off into the sunset wearing his cool hat and cool coat. Be like, I was never here.
Where's Albus? Oh, he said he was going to the store to get some milk.
That was 20 years ago.
Or 1 year ago, if you ask Alan. All right.
Any hoozles. That's that for the screenplay for those two scenes. So, I did actually look ahead to that to see if there was any explanation. You'll have to keep listening to find out, listeners, but there wasn't.
Nope.
So that's it for the main discussion.
Woo! Yay. I love going through these with the screenplay. I think it's very interesting.
Yes. Yeah, like, I hadn't really looked at the screenplay before I was writing up the doc for this, so I was watching the movie on HBO Max and following along on the screenplay, and I had forgotten so much about the early parts of the movie, and that Theseus actually does drop the Q-bomb very early on.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I forgot they even mentioned the Keelan at all in that scene.
Mm-hmm. It's so funny now that we've had those deleted scenes. Like, it just makes so much more sense had that scene been in there.
It does!
Why would you cut that? It only saved you a few minutes.
Yeah, what, like, was the scene... I don't even know what they would have replaced it with, but, like... Was the extra long pan on Teddy and Pickett in the Erkstag that much worth it? Like, was it worth it?
But if they kept this scene where... Because there the transition between China and Nurmengard and then Hogsmeade, it's really... The transition are quite good. So if you put that scene... I guess it would be just after the escape from China with the wyvern.
Yeah.
So they had the transition. But then you have... it works. It works. Yeah. Because you have the transition with the baby chilling to the other.
Yeah.
Right.
So it still works. Yeah, they should keep this scene.
Now, every time I watch the movie, I'm just going to have to pause it right there and then go and watch the scene and then hit on pause.
And then the movie will make slightly more sense.
So, time for the time turner?
Yes.
Yes.
A few times should do it, love.
Of course, I have a segment to do, so I had to do a time turner. And so today, since we had our first scene of the movie in Nurmengard, I thought it would be a good time to explore the history of the main historical inspiration for Nurmengard, which is the German city and castle of Nuremberg, or Nuremberg in English, I guess. Nuremberg en français. So Nuremberg, unlike Nuremberg, is not a lost castle in the mountains. It's a city, and it's the second largest city in Bavaria. And the city has a long and prestigious history since the Middle Ages. It was an imperial city and an imperial castle, and it's there that Frederick II was elected as Holy Roman Emperor in 1211. And it was later the heart of the German Renaissance in the 15th and 16th centuries. So very prestigious history there. So that's why it was chosen by the Nazi Party to become their ideological capital, and especially the reference to the Holy Roman Empire, because that's one of the plans of the Nazis to restore the German Empire like it was in the Middle Ages. And it's in Nuremberg that they had their biggest rallies between the late 20s and also the annual Nazi conventions in the 30s. And it's also from there, in 1935, that Hitler ordered the Reichstags to pass the Nuremberg laws, which was anti-Semitic and racist laws. And if you want another parallel with the Wizarding World, it's the Nuremberg laws, which were the inspiration of what we see in Deathly Hallows under Voldemort's regime. So,
yeah. Oh, okay.
So the fact that, yeah, so these laws are, they include, for example, they forbidden marriage between German and non-German people, especially Jews and other, because they also deprived Jews from their German citizenship. And so, yeah, that's what happened with the anti-Muggles laws in Deathly Hallows. Mm-hmm. And during the World War II, the city was heavily bombed by the Allies. And in January 1945, 90% of the medieval center was destroyed in only 1 hour by the Royal Air Force and the U.S. Army Air Force. And actually, when you see pictures from the bombing, it's really close from the vision of war that that Grindelwald show in movie 2, at the end of movie 2.
Oh, you're right.
Yeah, and it makes me think that what Grindelwald shows in this vision is really the German side, because he says that look at what the Muggles will do, and he's showing the Allies bombing German cities, because we see the planes and they are Royal Air Force planes, they are Spitfires, and he also showed the nuclear bomb, which of course it's a US bomb. So
right.
So at first I was thinking that he want to show just the war, including the Nazi as Muggle who do bad things, but he really shows the Allies' destruction.
Yeah.
Interesting. I never thought of that before. So
yeah.
Moving back to Nuremberg, the devastation of the city continues a few months later in April with the Battle of Nuremberg, when it took 4 days for the U.S. Army to take the city from the Nazi German Army, despite the German forces being largely outnumbered by the Americans. And the urban combats during these 4 days are known to be the fiercest of World War II. It was really atrocious during 4 days. And after the war, Nuremberg was chosen to be the site of the International Tribunal to judge the German officials involved in war crimes and in crimes against humanity. And yeah, and the Palace of Justice was one of the only standing buildings in the city. So
wow.
It was the perfect place. So yeah. So that's the history of Nuremberg. And if you see what Nuremberg looks like today, it's pretty nice. It looks like they restored a lot of the medieval look to the city. The castle look pretty nice. And yeah, I think it's a nice place to visit, but it has a heavy historical background.
Yes.
Yeah.
So,
does look pretty.
Yeah. So the name Nuremberg is probably itself a reference to Nuremberg. Mm-hmm. And funnily enough, I saw online that some have seen a potential nod to Tolkien in Nuremberg. They think it's a contraction of Numenor and Isengard.
Oh, yeah. They're taking the hobbits to Nuremberg.
Because I didn't went too deep into that, but I think Isengard, it's something, it's a tower built by the Numenors, and after it was corrupted by Saruman, so it's also it has the same idea behind that it's a place that is corrupted by evil, and then justice took place there when the Aragorn and so on liberated the place. So it works also to have this prominent, I guess. But yeah, one of the big difference between Nuremberg and Nuremberg is that Nuremberg was built by Grindelwald. It's not a reappropriation of an old place with ideological meaning. And the other thing that I found interesting is that Nuremberg in the books, it's not presented as the headquarters for Grindelwald. It's, I think, only a prison for his enemies.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So in the movies, Nuremberg is closer from Nazis Nuremberg, I guess, even if it's just a little castle, it's not a whole city. But of course, the biggest parallel is the fate after the war. So a symbol of power, terror, for the tyrant to turn into a place where he is judged or imprisoned. So, yeah. So that's your little history lesson.
Thank you. Very fascinating.
I love it. That'll be our next meetup.
In Nuremberg. Yeah. No, I'm sorry, Nuremberg.
Nuremberg.
God bless it.
Not Nuremberg. So that wraps up this episode. For our podcast question this week, we want to know, why do you think the Bloodtroth flies away from Dumbledore? Is it trying to escape him? Is it trying to go to Grindelwald? Is it just chilling? I don't know.
chilling.
Yeah. We would love to hear from you. So drop us an owl on any of our social media outlets or email us at speakbeastie@gmail.com. And don't forget to leave us a review on Apple Podcasts. That really helps us out. Thank you.
And you can also find us on Twitter and Instagram at speakbeastie, on Facebook at facebook.com/speakbeastie, on Tumblr at speakbeastiepodcast.tumblr.com, and you can support the show over on Patreon at patreon.com/speakbeastie. We have a exclusive common room on Facebook for Patreon members that's always hopping with some great stuff. We also have stickers and other merchandise that gets mailed out every single month to our Patreon supporters, and other content that gets uploaded there for you all to see.
Yeah, like for some of the exclusive content this month, we just released the video of Amy's and my interview with Robin Guyver. So if you want to see Amy and I rocking identical hairstyles and exactly how many fingers I busted up at that time in my life, that's all there for you to see. I guess that wraps it up.
Sure does.
Nate's not the only awkward one. I'm Anne.
I'm Marjolaine.
And I'm Shannon. Case closed.